Folks, this podcast has created its own sort of implied vacuum here in that the need for some sort of social media presence was sort of warranted. I have created an Instagram page for this podcast, so go look me up at Box Number 7 Instagram. I'm going to put it in the show description as well, a link or at least the at, you know, the usual sort of informational things that get laid there before I get started here. I wanted to put that out at the outset. That will be where I place supplemental photographs and things that I mention on this show, since it is an audiological pursuit only right now. I have a face for podcasting. I have a face for radio. Not sure that me and the YouTube thing are ever going to dance, but in the event that we do, there we go. Okay, what is it about Jane Austen and her classic stories that keep people coming back again and again and again? No matter how many adaptations, reconfigurations, or transmogrifications the story goes through, people seem to faithfully show up to see the drama between Elizabeth Bennet, Mr. Darcy, and a whole other cast of characters. Well, I'm going to add one more log to the quasi-literary fire today as we discuss Austen's Pride and a local production on Box Number 7. If you happen to be like me and be the father of daughters, and furthermore, the father of daughters that you managed to homeschool, then classical literature was going to be kind of one of the literary apexes around which their existence would ultimately revolve. So the thing about that is you can't help but sort of be sucked into the vortex of the female id, no matter how small they are, as you go along. And so throughout the years that I was raising, that we were raising our girls, I managed to see every possible incarnation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. I mean, there are offshoots, there are one-offs, there are parallels, there are, if I remember right, there's animated, illusory, metaphorical takes on it. There is, in the more recent years, after they were grown, there was one that I expected to be atrociously stupid, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which turned out to actually be one of the best takes on the genre without in any way compromising the story trek on it. And I don't mean that it's blood and guts and eating brains. There's a weird sort of, Pyrrhic underclass that the zombies are. They are sentient and they are operating amongst the living. Anyway, it's just a really great idea, at least in cinema. I have read, I think, just the original Jane Austen book, but somewhere after I managed to see that that zombie version, I thought, well, if the cinematic version is this good, the book must be incredible. I mean, that is the natural logical track that happens between cinema and book. However, I am just going to say at the outset that that book was so horrible. I wouldn't use that book to prop up the short leg on a table that I was getting ready to burn. That's how bad that book was. And I had bought the sequel at the same time. I didn't even bother. Gave them away or they're in a box somewhere. I don't know. The books are the undead. The books are zombified as far as I'm concerned. But I don't want to talk about that. I just wanted to talk about an incarnation of Pride and Prejudice that I happened to witness, not cinematically, not through the portal of literature, but through The classical presentational framework of a play, particularly small theater presentation, and even though the presentation was local, I'm putting it in the podcast because the play itself has farther-reaching implications, especially if you ever wind up going to Broadway. I think that this particular presentational framework could easily make it there for a couple of reasons. Anyway, last night I attended the Reading Performing Arts Center, Reading, California, to witness what is called Austin's Pride. I didn't know why that title was given the title that it was. I didn't know if it had some sort of, you know, modern political culture war sort of feel to it. I didn't know. But I thought, well, let's go see this thing. And so we went. And I'll tell you what, I am not a fan of anything that really takes the classical core out of a great work and removes it and replaces it in in verbal terms. There's a word called sophistry. Happens a lot in the modern era where words are emptied of their original meaning. They are scraped out, hollowed, and then they are filled with all new meanings, and then the original respect for the original meaning is demanded, even though it means exactly the opposite. Oh, by the way, I am recording this. If you hear wind and cars, I am once again at Kaleidoscope Coffee, Athens Avenue, Redding, California. This might become a recurring feature for me because I like to come here, and two, I like to run my mouth. Usually it's with someone across the table, but today, just slightly different. Austin's Pride, performed by the Redding Performing Arts Center. It was directed by Brandon Bowman. It was written by Lindsay Warren Baker and Amanda Jacobs. They are not local people. These are the folks that are hoping to take this thing to a national level. My understanding is that the Reading Performing Arts Center is one of the few, if not the first, theatrical component to license this for public performance. Now, at least that's what the director stated. I don't know if Brandon was meaning a regional thing. I'm not in this line of work. I am in show business, but not acting. So real quick, let me just go down what this was. I'll just give you the overview, try not to generally spoil it, but what you have essentially at its core is Pride and Prejudice. But off to the left, you have the author Jane Austen, who is not who has not yet written the work. And her sister, I believe it's her sister, Cassandra, is sort of trying to be the wind beneath her wings, you know, the gales in her sails, as they say, to get her to finish this completed work because of there's this this demand. And so as she nudges her along, Pride and Prejudice begins to take shape out of the pen of Miss Jane Austen. And as it is developing out of her pen, the activity on the stage begins to take place. But it's not just that. It's not just a sort of like transmission or a telegraphing of the words as they hit the paper and just blankly laying out in a linear fashion. The storyline, what you have is Austen struggling with character development. And as the play goes on, even the characters begin to interact. They break the fourth wall, but not with the audience. They break this fourth wall. It's technically only the third wall, but it is a fake. It is a pseudo, an ersatz fourth wall with Austen herself and even her sister Cassandra. And so at some times, the character begins to head in a direction that isn't commensurate with the story and then begins to argue for different levels of their correct place, their station, their desire for supremacy, who they want to marry, things like that. And you can see that this is sort of a speculative work as well. Did Austen, like any writer, like any person who ever wrote a novel, they probably had plot holes that they didn't see, or they had characters they meant to end up in a certain place and at the end of the day wound up in a completely different place. And that's essentially what you have here. One of the greatest moments, the funniest moments, is Mrs. Bennett. So you have to be familiar with the story. I'm not going to describe who everyone is, but Mrs. Bennett, by the way, played by, let me see, who was that? Mrs. Bennett, yeah, we'll get to that in a minute, but absolutely off the hook, Mrs. Bennett. Oh, yeah. Hold on, I've got it right here. This matters in a few minutes as I'm talking. Mrs. Bennett, the one who is attempting to marry her daughters. Excuse me, not Mrs. Bennett, Mrs. Bailey. No, Mrs. Bennett was played by Michelle Bailey. Sorry, if she ever hears this. No, Mrs. Bennett was played by Michelle Bailey, who not only pulled off the part, there was a level of histrionics and hysterics that were not overblown. This is a person who apparently has never really acted before and was able to pull off this perfect hybrid of Carol Burnett and Lucy Arnaz and possibly a Laverne and Shirley kind of deal, but without ever cheapening the nature of the role. It was actually an intoxicating part that she played, and you really couldn't take your eyes off her because she really was one of the apexes around which the story goes. As I said, they don't violate the integrity of the story, and as things go along, they're arguing for their place. And at one point, in one of the more classical scenarios, or one of the more classic scenes in Pride and Prejudice, you have a moment where Mrs. Bennett is demanding that her daughter marry one person and goes to the father and attempts to hedge her marital leverage, shall we say, in a way against her husband. And she said, "I have told our daughter that if she does not marry, I believe it's Mr. Collins, then I will never speak to her again." And then the husband, of course, stands up and says, "Well, we're in quite a quandary here." And he looks at his daughter and he says, "Well, this creates quite a problem because your mother states that if you marry Mr. Collins, she's never going to speak to you again." And then he says, "However, if you marry Mr. Collins, I will never speak to you again." And that gave the daughter permission to extricate herself from a relationship that was going to be arranged and not born of her own emotional attachment to someone. So that's the scenario that everyone's familiar with. Well, at that point, the mother normally throws a hysterical kind of fit and then storms off. And, you know, the scene seems somewhat victorious for the nature of love. But instead, she runs toward the edge of the stage and she starts saying, I just want to die. And then immediately looks over at Jane Austen and tries to stop her from writing that part. And she's, no. And so it's those sort of fourth wall interactions that that make this a completely different take on things. Really worth it. I want to just talk about the cast and crew and the musicians for a minute. Even though these folks are local, I just want to say, if you ever get a chance to see Austin's Pride anywhere in the country, go see it. It hasn't been modernized. It's not some modern double entendre loaded anachronistic pseudo political foot stomping tirade about anything. It has no commentary, no social commentary, no political commentary, nothing like it. If you love Pride and Prejudice, this in no way would ever violate any of your perceived norms. As a matter of fact, it would only seek to accentuate them. And so I know the goal is for them to take this nationwide, maybe worldwide as well. So just really quick, though, I have to give a major shout out to everyone involved. Director Kenneth Brandon Bowman. Also, he goes as Brandon. That's how I know him as. I've actually been involved in some other professional and entertainment pursuits where he has been sort of like the stage director for those. But he's never directed me, and I'm not an actor, and I would never pretend to be. Lighting operator Levi Schultz. I don't know if I'm saying this right. Chris Lytle for sound. Lighting and set design, again, Kenneth Bowman. The set construction built by Season Schultz, Janet Birkenpass, and Brandon Bowman himself. By the way, that director was also conducting the orchestra, so he was doing this literally. The orchestra was made up of last night a cello player, a piano player, and a percussionist. And I will get to them in a moment as well. Costumes, Aaron Brown, dialect coach, Kelsey Swanstrom. And by the way, great job. Don't know Kelsey. Great job on helping to cultivate what were, to me, flawless British accents from literally everyone. That's one of the things about something like this. If you're going to try British accents, you know, I can't imagine what trying to do British accents in Kentucky or South Carolina is like, but Northern California isn't really that big of a stretch. The British accents were off the hook, not distracting, and completely believable. And just trust me on this. I know what believable is. I don't know what dramaturge means here, but Devin Yeary, assistant coach, Megan Owens, assistant director, stage manager, Megan Owens, choreographer, Catherine Knoll. There was dance, and of course, this was a musical with some fantastic songs. Again, understandable, bite-sized, nothing drug on, you know, into, you know, long, drawn-out, overproduced sort of things. It gets to its point. As they say, it gets on the tarmac, it achieves altitude, and then lands. Let's see, Catherine Knoll, choreographer, choreographer's assistant, Deborah Leedy. The orchestra, Brandon Bowman conducting, the pianist. I guess Brandon also plays occasionally, which, boy, that would really make it a chore for him to conduct and play. But last night, it was Alda Turgieva, I want to say, or Turgieva. I do apologize if I mess up these names. Cello, Jacqueline Dennis. What a lovely lady that was playing that cello and did such a great job. And I expressed to her how I realized if you could talk to Hans Zimmer or John Williams or any of these modern conductors, the cello, it really is the most important instrument in all of cinematic scoring. There was apparently there was a person who was slated to play the French horn, Elizabeth Voynovic, I want to say, and percussion, Ever Adams. I met Ever last night. I've never met someone with the name Ever, but what a cool name. All right, let's go through the cast real quick. Sarah Yoder played Cassandra Austin. Jane Austen was played by Stephanie Rogers. They were, by the way, so phenomenally fantastic and believable and animated, and everything was so professional. Elizabeth Bennet played by Shannon, again, Froelich, looks like a German name. It's got some accents. Fitzwilliam Darcy, Mr. Darcy. What a stoic and regal character he played. Jeff Grant played that part. Jane Bennet played by Aaron Van Maul. Also, Aaron is married to local director Luke Van Maul, who recently produced the film Miracle Mile. It has a faith-based thread running through it. Well done. Well done film. And one of the first really, really well-produced films for a local effort here. Deserves a wider audience for sure. Charles Bingley was played by Daniel Chabon. Carolyn Bingley. There's a few actors for this. Taylor, Janine Jassian, or Brianna Hagen. Not sure who it was last night. Lydia Bennet played by Taylor, Janine Jassian, or Brianna Hagen. So apparently I saw both of them last night, but they were apparently interchanging characters is going to be my logical guess. Kitty Bennet played by Vita Morris Casper, Mary Bennet, played by Libby Oliver, Mrs. Bennet, Michelle Bailey, the incomparable Michelle Bailey. Great job, Mr. Bennet, Simon Knopf, Mr. Wickham, Auden, I want to say Girk, possibly Gerky. Again, my apologies. Mr. Collins was played last night by Philip Patterson, who, by the way, if you're listening to this, has a distinct Jack Black vibe, so just keep that in mind if one of those other, you know, music class, pyrotechnic teacher, offshoot sort of productions manages to hit the radar. There was another actor, Casimir Crozier, that I don't think I met last night, unless they were playing another part. Lady Catherine by Megan Owens or Shelley Thompson, Mrs. Gardner, Sandy I want to say Andrzejewski, but I'm not sure I got that right. Mr. Gardner, Tim Watson, or Bill Hagen, Georgiana Darcy, Emily Holloway. And then we have the ensemble Redcoat folks, Jana Frankie, Jesse Jones, Dawson Green. And then in the standard ensemble, Shelley Thompson, Emily Larkins, and Janet Birkenpass. I just wanted to give the local shout outs for the locals here that are listening to this podcast, and I'm starting to actually build an audience, which is great. The other thing is I wanted to give throw the larger net out for something as great as Austin's Pride. It's a definite script that I believe in. I love the story of Pride and Prejudice anyway. I love the Victorian sensibilities. I love the essential ideas of class struggle and things like that in that period of time. And this production struggled not to find itself in the upper class. Anyway, that's going to be it for box number 7. I'm working on my next episode, which hopefully, if I get it right, will involve the more recent and contemporary discussions of all things the Shroud of Turin. So there you go. That's my little short bonus episode here. Live from Kaleidoscope Coffee on Sunday morning. I'm going to sip the rest of my coffee, and I'll post this thing as soon as I can. Bye.